5 hours was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United Nations is calling for an international inquiry into Saturday's airstrike in Yemen for possible war crimes. The strike hit a funeral gathering in the capital Sana'a, killing 140 and wounding hundreds. The Saudi-led coalition is suspected. Riyadh has launched an investigation. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon denounced the attack.
Saturday's funeral bombing was a heartless attack on civilians and an outrageous violation of international humanitarian law.
He said the incident demands a full inquiry. The UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein renewed his call for an investigation, saying the bombing of a funeral cannot go unpunished. His spokesperson is Ravina Shamdasani.
He's calling on the international community to take action. The High Commissioner regrets that the Human Rights Council, in two successive years, has dismissed the High Commissioner's call for an independent international inquiry into the allegations of serious human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law in Yemen.
UN envoy to Yemen Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed said in his words, everything possible must be done to ensure the authors of these heinous crimes face justice. Ethiopia is blaming regional rival Egypt for supporting rebels of the Oromo Liberation Front, or OLF, amid an uptick in anti-government unrest that prompted Addis Ababa to declare a state of emergency Sunday. Gerrit Jureta is a government spokesman.
The terrorist group OLF has been receiving all kinds of support from Egypt. Its leaders have been feted. I mean, it used to be in Asmara, now they are feted in Cairo. And of course, they have been given all kinds of instructions to destabilize this country.
Egypt last week denied any support of the Ethiopian rebels. Rights and opposition activists say at least 400 have been killed in anti-government protests in the past year. This is VOA News. French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault joined UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Monday in calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate possible war crimes committed by Russia in Syria. He referred to airstrikes that have killed civilians in rebel-held Aleppo. He joined U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who made a similar appeal last week. The U.N. has called for a massive response to the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Haiti following last week's major hurricane that has killed hundreds and destroyed homes and crops on a wide scale. Rudolf Muller directs the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Geneva.
The government of Haiti and the humanitarian countries team Flash Appeal seeks to provide life-saving assistance and protection to 750,000 people out of 1.4 million people in need over the next 3 months. To do so, we urgently need to mobilize $119 million.
The money is to be used to provide food, drinking water, and shelter. The powerful hurricane named Matthew slammed into Haiti, the Dominican Republic, the Bahamas, and Cuba Tuesday and Wednesday, leaving widespread death and destruction, the worst such storm in the Caribbean in a decade. British-born Oliver Hart and Bengt Holmström of Finland jointly won the 2016 Nobel Prize for Economics for their work on contract theory with implications in the areas of corporate governance, bankruptcy law, and political constitutions. Holmström, a professor of economics and management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said he was grateful to receive the prize.
Of course, very gratifying to get this prize, but at the same time one understands that, you know, there are a lot of deserving people.
Hart is an economics professor at Harvard. The 9 academics receiving Nobel Prizes this year include 5 Britons, a Frenchman, a Finn, a Dutchman, and a Japanese, 6 based at U.S. universities. The Islamic State has confirmed the death of one of its most senior leaders, whom the Pentagon said was killed September 7th in a precision airstrike near Raqqa, Syria. The IS statement praised Wa'il Adil Hassan Salman al-Fayed, also known as Abu Muhammad al-Furqan. He was the militant group's Minister of Information, overseeing propaganda. Burundi Monday banned 3 UN investigators from its territory. They're linked to a report which identified Burundian officials suspected of ordering political opposition members to be tortured or killed. The 3 had reported gross human rights violations in the wake of last year's decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek an unconstitutional third term. South Korean-based electronics giant Samsung is halting sales of its Galaxy Note 7 smartphone after a second statement released Monday over its replacement of the original product also overheating and possibly catching fire. Samsung already has recalled 2.5 million phones. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa and the Voice of America. I'm James Bhatti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A member of the university student protest in South Africa says they will continue their protest for a tuition-free education.
We are introducing a new kind of protest where we just not protest and go back to our rooms and sleep, but we must be able to protest a day and then at night have conversations of actually what are we doing, because we can never carry out this mandate without intellectualism.
That's Matla Mbuyisa of the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Two rights groups call on Guinea's government to bring to justice those behind last year's post-election violence. Cameroon deploys the Navy to seize illegal fishing vessels, and a senior South Sudan military official resigns.
The country, the peace is dead. No peace in the country. People are dying, killing the civilians based on ethnic nationality.
Lieutenant General Mapini Mutwil is South Sudan's Deputy Chief of General Staff. Psychological first aid helps people with mental health problems, and diabetes blood sugar tests can be made more accurate. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A member of the university student protest for tuition-free education in South Africa says their protest will continue, but on two levels. Matla Mbuyisa of the University of KwaZulu-Natal and a member of the Fees Must Fall movement says the students will protest during the day and educate the student population and civil society at night because, he says, the movement cannot survive without what he calls intellectualism. This comes after police clashed with hundreds of students on Monday as the universities attempted to reopen. The police said the protesters tried to prevent their fellow students from attending classes. But Mbuyisa says the movement understands that if it is to be successful, it cannot antagonize other students.
The clash between the student and the police comes from a place of protest, where the students of the country are protesting for fees to fall, of which we are speaking to education being used as a tool of colonization. So we are trying to redress that colonial question. So we know that if you are trying to raise a colonial question to try to decolonize the society that we exist in, it's going to be very violent. So the police, as a tool used by the system to maintain itself, they are going to be very violent against us. They are going to shoot us. They are going to kill us. They are going to do all sort of things, because Fees Must Fall as a movement tries to redress these questions.
First of all, the police say that the clashes started because you, the students, as the university tried to reopen, you were going from classroom to classroom, disrupting classes.
That is not true. It's actually false what they are saying, because if you check out our media statements as Fees Must Fall, we have said that we are having peaceful protest, and there are no students that can tell you that we have actually went to class and disrupted classes physically. You see, we have not done that because we understand that we as students, we cannot antagonize ourselves. So if we are going to be able to mobilize students, actually students be able to listen to us, we must be very clear, and our narrative must be very clear, because we are not fighting them, but we want them to think. So if we are going to fight them, we are going to lose them.
Have you been in contact with the South African Minister of Education? Because one thing I read was that the Minister of Education wants to dialogue, but he believes that the movement is being overtaken by some radical students.
That is very problematic again. What is radical to Blade's terms? And we have not run away from dialogue. When the fees commission was taking place within the country, we have went into those spaces in Eastern Cape, in Cape Town, in KwaZulu-Natal, and said to those people, we want to have a conversation with you. But what they do is that they call the police on us. And Minister Blade Nzimande, he's lying when he says he wants to speak to the movement. Because what he does, they do the divide and rule tactic.
You say that you believe in dialogue, but you believe that the Minister of Education is involved in a divide and rule. So let me ask you, how united is the student movement?
The student movement right now, as it stands, it's not united. There's no principal unity. That's why we see the selling out of students. Many students have been sold out. Some of them arrested as we speak right now because a certain people within the university premises are going to tell the state forces that these are the people who are planning, these are the people who are actually mobilizing. I myself, I've been receiving death threats.
So what do you intend to do? Are you going to continue the protests?
Yes, we are continuing with the protests. But now we are introducing a new kind of protest where we just not protest and go back to our rooms and sleep. But we must be able to protest a day and then at night have conversations of actually what are we doing, because we can never carry out this mandate without intellectualism.
Madla Umbuyisa is a student at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and a member of the Fees Must Fall movement. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. A senior military official in the South Sudan Army has resigned. Deputy Chief of General Staff for Moral Orientation, Lieutenant General Bapini Mutwil, announced his resignation Monday in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, saying President Salva Kiir's administration is not willing to implement the August 2015 peace deal. He also accused the president of using the military to kill South Sudanese based on their ethnicity. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Nairobi.
Dressed in a dark blue suit and a white shirt, Lieutenant General Bapini Mutwil told the journalists at a press conference organized by the leadership of the South Sudan Democratic Movement, Cobra Faction, under the leadership of General Khalid Boutros, who recently defected from the Kiir's administration. Mutwil said his residency in Juba was raided by soldiers who were acting under the command of the leadership of the South Sudan Army.
When I go to German, General Chief of Staff, he ordered the security to disarm all my guards, to take all the weapons, to cut all their salaries. Also, he arrests 43 officers in Mayom County. They say that they are loyal to me because I am going to join Riek Machar. They sent again another mission to my resident in Juba to search for everything regarding guns, anything regarding my military equipment. So they took all, even the communication, radio communication, everything. That is why I resigned from the government as a deputy chief of staff from today.
Mutwil traveled to Germany for medical purposes in March. He claims the government has been harassing individuals from his ethnic community, accusing them of supporting former FAST Vice President Riek Machar. He says the behavior of some senior government officials towards members of his ethnic group has forced him to resign. President Salva Kiir issued an amnesty for Bapini Mutwil, leader of the Ndene Rebel South Sudan Liberation Army and their troops in 2013. Mutwil says the 2015 peace agreement has been abrogated by the Kiir's administration.
The country, the peace is dead. No peace in the country. People are dying, killing the civilians based on ethnic nationality.
He says there must be more inclusive dialogue as part of a solution to the challenges facing the country. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lulurwai Kwang had a little to say on his boss' resignation.
I'm not going to comment until I consult with the high military authority.
General Bapini Mutwil, brother to Northern Leech State Governor Joseph Mutwil, was a former rebel leader fighting the government in the northern parts of the country. But he was integrated along with some 1,300 of his forces into the government army in 2013. Last year, the general was appointed Deputy Chief of General Staff for Moral Orientation. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 11th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Today, Monday, is the first anniversary of the October 11th 2015 presidential election in Guinea-Conakry, and Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are calling on the government of President Alpha Condé to bring to justice members of the security forces and mobs linked to the deadly election-related violence. Corinne Dufka, Associate Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, says investigating and bringing those responsible to justice will signify a major step forward in ending the cycle of abuse and impunity in Guinea.
1 year on after the election last year, there has been very little progress indeed in investigating and holding to account both security force members and members of opposition and ruling party mobs that resulted in the deaths of 12 people, the looting of scores of marketplaces, and a number of other abuses, including rape. So what we're asking is for the president, who has put justice at the top of his agenda rhetorically, to ensure that these abuses are investigated and those responsible held to account.
You have written a letter to President Alpha Condé?
That's right. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International wrote a joint letter to the president in which we provided some details about these different cases and then urged him to ensure that his government acted promptly to investigate and hold those responsible.
So you said members of the security forces were implicated in the violence, and so has that been proven?
Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International did a number of missions to Guinea in the pre-election period. And together we documented numerous incidents, including 10 killings allegedly by members of the security forces and 2 killings by mobs allegedly supporting the opposition, as well as 3 cases of sexual violence, 1 by the gendarmes, another 1 by mobs supporting the opposition, and a 3rd 1 by supporters of the ruling party. So we, in this letter, laid out some of the details of these cases and then urged the president to ensure that the judiciary investigates and holds those responsible to account.
Corinne, how many people are we talking about right now in terms of victims, and what sort of justice are you looking for? Are you looking for financial compensation or what?
Yeah, we're looking for, of course, financial compensation is part of justice. Reparations is also a key issue for the scores and scores of market sellers and business people whose markets were looted during the violence, particularly just a few days before the October 11th election. You'll recall that Medina Market, the Centre Commis, a number of markets were looted, and hundreds of business people lost all of their property and a great deal of money, for many, their entire life savings. About 400 of these market sellers have presented a complaint, so they have sought justice through the judiciary, which is a positive sign.
I'm assuming this is not the first communication you've had with the Guinean government. Have you had any response from the government?
Yes, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have brought up these abuses since the elections last year, and we've been disappointed that there has been very little progress in investigating these cases.
Corinne Dufka is the Associate Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Cameroon has deployed its navy to seize illegal fishing vessels off the country's southwestern coast. Tensions have risen there as local communities say foreign trawlers are fishing in protected areas and destroying resources. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited the coastal town of Limbe and has this report.
Fifteen armed sailors of Cameroon's navy searched the high seas off the Central African state's Atlantic coast for illegal fishing boats scooping up large amounts of sea life for export. Lieutenant Colonel Emmanuel Sonny, the highest navy official in southwest Cameroon, says within 2 weeks, the navy has seized 6 Chinese vessels with crews from China and Cameroon.
The evidence was clear. These people were catching species that were prohibited within our waters. And last night, when the maritime patrol was out there, they actually found more vessels than this one. Just to tell you that the illegal activities in our waters is just too much. And even though we are doing our best to carry out repression, it is not enough for now.
Several countries' coast guards in the region have struggled to respond to a dramatic increase in the number of foreign fishing vessels. Sonny says the majority of the unauthorized fishing operations in his area are Chinese, but other nationalities are also involved, including Nigerians, Ghanaians, and Kenyans. Cameroon's most senior fishery official, based in the southwest, Walter Ndi, says some of the Chinese have registered under Cameroonian businesses but refuse to respect fishing norms.
For industrial fishing, fishing vessels are not supposed to go beyond 3 nautical miles from the coastal areas. These areas are areas that the artisanal fishermen can carry out their normal activities without any conflict. These are areas for reproduction. So for sustainable management of our fishing resources, industrial fishermen are not supposed to go there because that is where you have the majority of the young fishes. It is from there that they are now able to move on to high sea for proper growth.
Limbe Association of Fisherwomen President Sarah Epule Kome says the local price of mackerel, a food staple in this area, has doubled.
If you go to the market now, you will only see some type of small fish. That's all what you will see in the market. You will not see anything good.
Limbe residents told VOA that last week, local fishermen beat up a group of foreign fishermen and took their equipment. Lucy Ekema sells fish caught by local fishermen.
The Chinese people have their nets. They will just throw something inside the sea. Fishes will go inside. Even the small fish. They wreck all. Then in the morning that my fisher people are going, look, Nana, look. You are seeing no fish. How can the common man live?
In a report released earlier this year, the Overseas Development Institute identified the western coast of Africa as a global epicenter of illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Local communities are paying the price. Moki, Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News, Limbe, Cameroon.
The World Health Organization says psychological first aid can provide a mental health lifeline to people affected by crises, including war, natural disasters, or an individual trauma like a car crash. On the occasion of World Mental Health Day, WHO is calling for first-line responders to emergencies such as police and firefighters to be trained in this practical, helpful approach. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Applying medical first aid in case of emergency can mean the difference between life and death. Less recognized is the important role psychological first aid plays in helping people cope with the trauma of sudden tragedies and in preventing them from turning into long-term mental disorders. World Health Organization Public Mental Health Advisor Mark van Ommeren says listening to people in crisis is key in any psychological first aid intervention.
Listening without pressuring people to talk about what happened. If people want to talk about what they went through, that is very fine. One listens. But if one person doesn't want to talk, one just listens to whatever the person wants to discuss.
Van Ommeren says it also is important to ask people in crisis about their needs and concerns. The first responder should provide information so people can access services and get the social support that will help them. He says psychological first aid was applied in Haiti 5 years ago after the devastating earthquake. He says this approach now is being used to help survivors of Hurricane Matthew, the latest disaster to hit this Caribbean island, deal with their emotional wreckage. He says aid agencies used this approach some months ago in Greece. At that time, he says, it was assumed the refugees and migrants who had survived the perilous Mediterranean Sea crossing would remain on the island for a short period.
So psychological first aid was very popular and appropriate for that situation to help arrivals quickly with whatever practical needs they had and giving them information and, if necessary, offering a listening ear.
However, the situation has changed. Most people are staying in Greece for much longer than expected. Sofan Omarin says they are in need of more than a quick psychological fix to help them overcome their mental distress. Psychological first aid has been used with success in countries around the world, including Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, during the recent Ebola epidemic. It is being offered widely in war-torn Syria and to thousands of displaced people in Greece and Nigeria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In one-third of people with diabetes, the so-called gold standard method for monitoring blood sugar levels is inaccurate. But scientists have found a way to fix the discrepancy, helping people to more effectively manage their disease. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
422 million people worldwide live with diabetes, according to the World Health Organization. Tightly controlling the amount of circulating sugar in the blood is considered the best way to reduce the likelihood of devastating complications, such as blindness, kidney failure, heart disease, and limb amputation. The so-called A1C test, which is considered the most accurate method for measuring glucose levels, is inaccurate in about 1 in 3 people. The A1C offers a snapshot of blood sugar levels based on a 3-month look back. The test is considered more accurate than daily blood sugar levels, which can vary minute by minute. The A1C measures the amount of sugar that's been absorbed by red blood cells for a period of time. When scientists compared daily glucose monitoring to A1C, they found discrepancies based on the age of the red blood cells, according to Harvard University Medical School Professor of Systems Medicine John Higgins. Red blood cells live an average of 45 days, but they live longer in some people, prompting this analogy by Higgins.
You know, it's, I think a simplistic analogy is just a sponge sitting on a damp counter, and the more water you have on your counter, the more soaked that sponge is going to get. But also, if you leave that sponge on a counter even longer, it's going to soak up more water.
In other words, the A1C level of a person whose blood sugar appears well controlled day to day may actually be elevated if that individual's red blood cells are older.
And the opposite is true as well. If someone's had a really high level of blood sugar, but their blood cells are pretty young, then it may look like they're fine when in fact their blood sugar's been high.
The findings were reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine. One way to correct for the discrepancy, according to Higgins, would be for someone to wear a device that continuously measures his or her blood sugar once for a short period of time and then compare it to an A1C reading. An adjustment could be made and permanently corrected in the lab. Higgins says it's a form of personalized medicine.
I think this study shows that we can look at laboratory tests that are already being collected and measured, and if we think mathematically about the physiology leading to those measurements, we can personalize monitoring and treatment for some of these diseases already.
By using a continuous glucose monitoring device, scientists were able to correct the accuracy rate of the A1C test from 1 in 3 people to 1 in 10. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Ethiopian government is blaming regional rival Egypt for supporting rebels and forcing Addis Ababa into declaring a state of emergency on Sunday. Egypt last week denied any support for the Ethiopian rebels. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
We'll be right back.
savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. UTC.